From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Why be a jazz master when it's so much more fun to be the star student on the bandstand? Jason Marcellus deserves a gold star for his work as a drummer and vibraphonist, as well as honorable mention for all the other instruments he plays. As a member of the first family of jazz, he's got to be good. But as a band leader and sideman, Marcellus says he has to practice more, perform more, and play even better.
You know, I mean, I think that if you're always a student of the music, there's always something that you can learn. And there's always something that you can push for. And that's something that the real masters understood.
Meet Jason Marcellus, Grasshopper, after the break. Jason Marcellus has gone on record calling the drums the single most important instrument in a jazz ensemble. And when you listen to him play, he's not wrong. Drums provide the thrust, the push, and the lift that allow a whole ensemble to take flight. Every note of every other instrument fits within the rhythmic structure and pace set by the drums. So what happens when the all-important drummer chooses to play a different instrument? Marcellus has taken up the glockenspiel, the marimba, the tubular bells, the xylophone, and most importantly, the vibraphone, an instrument that's been seducing drummers ever since Herbert Hoover was president. The Jason Marcellus Vibes Quartet is enjoying nearly universal critical acclaim. The group has released two albums, and the latest is called the 21st Century Trad Band. While much of the music from the album offers a fresh take on traditional New Orleans music, it's an unmistakable work of modern jazz. Jason Marcellus and his vibraphone join us here at Marini Recording Studio. Thanks so much for coming out.
It is a pleasure to be here. This is a show that I've actually enjoyed listening to. There were some great interviews I've heard with some of my great musician friends that I also look up to as mentors. So I'm glad to be doing this show.
Now, we should mention that, yes, your vibraphone is here, but there's also a drum set. And
yes.
Now, you know, is looking at a drum set now like looking at an old girlfriend?
No.
Are you like somebody that, you know, been there, done that?
Yeah, no. You mean, you know, old girlfriends, that's it. You know, that's over with. In this case, no, that isn't the case, just because, you know, there is a purpose for both drums and vibes, and there's still a lot to be played on either instrument. And I still work with the drums. I do lead my own group playing vibes, and I have done shows with other musicians on vibes, but I still work with pianist Marcus Roberts and my father, pianist Ellis Marcellus, and saxophonist John Ellis, and various people. I mean, so I still use the drum kit, you know,
yeah.
Still have to practice it.
I believe it. You know, some drummers say they grew up jumpy. You know, they were always percussive, beating or tapping on something. Were you that way?
Yeah, that was me. Yeah, it was. Yeah, there's people that have various stories about straws and pencils, so that would be correct.
You are a percussive child.
Oh, yes.
So, true. I mean, your family, the Marsalises, you're known nationally as the first family of jazz. You know, your dad's a musician. You've got three brothers who are musicians.
Yeah, it's a very inaccurate title, but yeah, it's complimentary. But, you know, we're from New Orleans. We know better.
Ah, okay. That's true. It's a city of families, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who are in the music business.
Oh, yes.
But
we know better.
But the thing about it is that, you know, your brothers are a bit older than you. And so you grew up in a different household than Wynton Marsalis or Branford Marsalis or maybe even Delfeo, you know. And also, what did the household that Jason Marsalis grew up in sound like?
It was a lot quieter. I mean, you'd think that there were drums there, but it'd be louder, but it wasn't. And it was very different in the sense of my first four older brothers were gone. They were, you know, Wynton and Branford were in New York, and eventually Ellis III settled in Baltimore, Maryland, and Delphia was in Boston for a minute. And now, he was in New Orleans, and I did see Delphia a lot, and we would play together, but he had his own house.
But as a kid, though, I mean, what are you hearing? What are you listening to in the house?
Yeah, well, pretty much, it's funny, as a kid, I was into jazz records. That's what I actually enjoyed. I mean, I have memories of when my older brother Wynton first started making his records. And it was a pretty big deal. And it wasn't even for career reasons. It wasn't that it was selling well and, oh, he's going to tour and this and that. It was just making a record was a big thing.
Sure.
And it was just something that felt like an event. First record would be played on the radio, and then I remember even when he came home to say, man, this is the new record we're working on. Like, you had musicians that were really believed in what they were doing and were working hard on trying to put the best music that they could put together at that time. It was that music. It was also Miles Davis recordings, like Kind of Blue, Milestones, and Someday My Prince Will Come. There were also, you know, some John Coltrane recordings I might listen to, like Giant Steps.
Yeah.
I was really into that album a lot. So, but I was really into jazz more so than the popular music at the time, actually. Thank you.
So there's Jason Marsalis with a juice box in one hand and like John Coltrane's giant steps in the other?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I think I had one of those old lunch pail boxes by then. Yeah, I think I had that then.
You know, in the beginning of your recording career, you wrote these terrific liner notes. You know, you've put out, I would say, about half a dozen albums, I want to say.
As a leader, yeah, about five, yeah.
Uh-huh. And, you know, and you talk about each of the songs, and you credit the musicians and the teachers who inspire you. And what's so interesting is that you start at the very beginning where you credit Warren Baby Dodds.
Yes.
Who played with Joe Oliver and Louis Armstrong, of course, in the Hot 7 band.
Yes.
Recordings were made in the late 20s. So, you know, I mean, how is Baby Dodds communicating with a kid, you know, in New Orleans, you know what I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, what, at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st?
Yeah, I think the reason for that was that as a kid, years didn't really matter. It was just, did you like it or not? I remember as a kid hearing some of the Hot 5 and Hot 7 recordings. And the records back then, you couldn't have drums. All you had were just, you could play on a cymbal or wood blocks. And you know, but it was music that I, you know, did enjoy. Now, it wasn't until later in high school that I actually did get later recordings of Baby Dodds.
Yes.
And I was really into those because I had never heard him at a drum kit.
The story goes that Baby Dodds was so particular about his drums that he wouldn't even play a drum that had any kind of words on the, you know, on the skins or on the sides, you know, like the name of an orchestra or something. He felt like that would change the sound of the drum. I mean, that's amazing to have that kind of standard at a time when recording, you know what I mean, was not as sensitive as it is today.
Well, the thing is that the musicians back then were more like craftsmen. You know, music was a craft. It wasn't a hustle to make some money. It wasn't a ticket to stardom. It was a craft. So when you practiced a press roll, that's what you did. It wasn't about how can we not do this or how can we get out of doing that or, oh, man, I got to do my thing like some of the peers in my generation started to do. But back then it was a craft. So you'd have guys that would work on, you know, we want to have a clean press roll. We don't want it to sound like ja, 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 ja. We want it to sound like bzzz. We want it to have a clean sound. And we're going to practice that for hours a day until we get it right. And that was a craft.
Okay, well, now I'm going to have to ask you to do a press roll.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely do that.
Okay.
So, for example, a press roll is when you're taking the left and right hand and you're creating these buzzes, but you bring them together. And you don't want it to sound like this. That's a pretty terrible sound. You want it to sound more like this. Now, mind you, Baby Dodds' press roll was 10 times cleaner than that, but nonetheless, that's what a press roll is, and you want the kind of sound that's very, as they say, like you're tearing a sheet of paper. When you tear a paper, shoo, and that's what you want. So when you're playing traditional music and you're playing those press rolls, you know. That's the sound you want. Well, actually better than that, but that's what you're trying to go for.
You're kind of hard on yourself. Your price roll sounded pretty good to me. And so, you know, in your liner notes, and I guess in your conversation as well, you know, you convey the spirit of why be a jazz master when it's so much more fun being a jazz student?
Yeah, that's true. You know, I mean, I think that if you're always a student of the music, there's always something that you can learn, and there's always something that you can push for. And that's something that the real masters understood.
Let me take you back, though, to Baby Dodds.
Yeah.
Okay. So is the drum set really that sensitive that, you know, that any little thing can change its sound, can change its texture?
It is, but, you know, there's those who have discussed the cleaning of cymbals. Do you clean them or not? And some say yes, some say no. Some,
oh.
Cleaning them does change the sound. Some think it's for the better, some think it's not. Some think that if you leave it alone, it will age, you'll get a warmer sound. So, you know, so it changes, but some drummers are great enough to where it doesn't matter what they're playing, they're gonna be great anyway.
Yeah, it's almost like a cook who can make something beautiful out of leftovers.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe a substandard material, but, you know, that can actually turn into a grade A experience.
Absolutely.
You know?
There is a way to do it.
So you were complimenting the hi-hat on this particular drum set, which is provided here by Marini Recording Studio. What's so great about that hi-hat?
It's really another device. It's another percussion instrument, and all of these percussion instruments that we have here with the hi-hat and the cymbal and the snare drum and bass drum and toms. It's interesting because in the evolution of the drum set, when you think of the early brass band music, you essentially did have an equivalent to the hi-hat, but what it was a cymbal on the bass drum.
Oh.
So that would sound more like... And you'd have like... You know, it's just something to sort of give an accent to the beat. And the same thing goes if you're playing on the cymbal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not supposed to overwhelm it, but you give a slight accent to the beat. Sometimes you can play the hi-hat just, you know, as is. You know, and so there's lots of uses. Of course, you know, most people know the hi-hat from being used, you know, in funk and rock music, you know. So, I mean, it definitely complements the drums in a very important way.
Am I supposed to recognize that song that you just played, that riff that you just played?
Not necessarily.
No?
I mean, it's a beat based on so many songs.
Exactly. It sounded like Michael Jackson.
I mean, yeah. Actually, yes. I mean, you know, there was Billie Jean.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's that beat's been used other places, you know. AC/DC's music has that.
Oh, sure. She was a fast machine, she cocked the motor and clean. She was the
best damn woman that I've ever seen. She had the same. You know, it's been used, you know, there's Parliament's music, there's Al Green, you know, there. We could go on and on. Stevie Wonder, blah, 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 blah.
This sounds like a pretty good party, actually.
Yeah. Tether the loop off, we're gonna tether the loop off, the mother sucker. Tether the loop off, the sucker.
tear the roof off, we're gonna tear the roof off the mother sucker. Tear the roof off the sucker.
Who goes from Warren Baby Dodds to Parliament in one conversation? Jason Marsalis, that's who. Coming up, we've got a real type of thing going down, getting down. There's a whole lot of rhythm going round. Jason Marsalis explodes the drum solo for the 21st century. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're talking with jazz drummer and vibraphonist Jason Marsalis. On each of Marsalis's albums, he dedicates at least one song to a character called Discipline. These are solo performances of the highest order, in which Discipline allows Marsalis to explore complex layers of rhythm. The song we're hearing now is called Discipline Strikes Again. In all, Marsalis has recorded 10 odes to discipline.
It dawned on me that in order to be a percussionist, you had to have discipline. But it wasn't about the style of music. It doesn't matter. You have to have that. For example, if you're playing in, say, an Afro-Cuban ensemble, there's a beat that's called the clave.
Okay.
And there's two important ones, but son is the more basic one, and the rhythm is like this. Now, there's other things that's going on around that. You know, you may have a cascada going on. That takes a certain kind of discipline to do
that.
Like the great drummer Elvin Jones said, you got to play a groove over 1,000 times and keep the same intensity going the whole time. That's discipline.
Yeah.
If you're playing classical music and you're playing a piece in which you have one crash cymbal hit after 3,864 measures of rest that you have to count through, and then you have to come in and hit that hit, that's discipline. If you're playing triangle and you're trying to get those, because a lot of people say, oh, triangle, yeah, you just get a stick and beat on the triangle. No, this is not the mom out in the country. There's a lot of sounds and timbres that you have to get out that accompanies the music, and you have to have discipline to get that right sound and that right timbre out of that instrument. If you're practicing paradiddles, what has changed about that sound? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. My father even had a story about James Black, someone who definitely had discipline on the drums.
Oh, the great New Orleans drummer.
Yes, the great New Orleans drummer and composer. But he even had a story about him practicing double stroke rolls for an hour on a pillow. For an hour. Okay?
Wow.
You have to have discipline to do that, because after a while, and believe me, I know that they got some drummers out here that will get bored with that very quickly. Man, why I got to keep doing the same thing? Man, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, it's a drummer, you know, ADHD drumming that goes on now. I know
ADHD
that,
drumming.
No, they're out there. I know they exist, believe me. I had a chance to study with James Black, who was my father's partner in crime. They made a lot of great music. And I was 7. I was really young, a little too young to really get it, honestly. But the one thing I remembered was he gave me a book by George Lawrence Stone called Stick Control.
Stick Control.
And what it is it's these exercises involving controlling your sticks and trying to get a good sound. And the way it works, he told me, yes, you read each line, you play each thing 20 times. And so page 3, what you have are these staffs of music, 2 measures and 8th notes. And what it says is, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, and you play that 20 times. Line 2, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, okay. Line 3, right, left, right, right, left, right, left, left, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. I mean, I don't think that any drummer's gotten past the first page. I don't think so. Maybe there are, but I just don't know. So that was the first time that I had ever heard of that book. The second time that it was reinforced was when I was assigned a lesson with Alan Dawson, who was one of the great teachers. Probably his most famous student would have been Tony Williams, who was with the Miles Davis Quintet.
Oh, yeah.
So during the lesson, he asked me, have you ever heard of this book, Stick Control? Yeah. And I did. So I think that that cemented that this is an important book.
This is true of every human undertaking, the idea that simple is deceptively difficult.
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely is.
And but the payoff is so great.
Absolutely.
You know,
there's no
so
doubt about
great.
It.
But the thing about your discipline recordings, okay, is that they are you essentially cloning yourself in the studio so that you are playing multi-layered tracks of rhythm.
Yes.
And this is something that can't be replicated on stage because it's you six times you.
Yes.
Okay. And so, but you consistently do it. And my guess is that you have found a way to push forward the drum solo, you know, which during those Buddy Rich years got kind of passé, you know. Mm-hmm. These 10-minute solos, you know. Where
it was just a lot of fast and loud playing.
Yeah, where the audience essentially just went to the restroom and came back, you know.
Right.
And all. So, but you have found a way to make it, I hate to say it this way, but you have found a way to make the drum solo interesting to the ADHD listener.
Yeah. Actually, but it's also interesting to the average listener, even if they don't have ADHD.
On one of your albums, you have a tune called Discipline, Spotted Baby, and Zootie at Studio 54.
Yes.
That's Baby Dodds and Zootie Singleton?
Zootie Singleton, yes.
Both New Orleans guys.
Yes.
Yes. Let's listen to a little bit of it. Going on there?
Yeah. Well, one of the ways I started to approach the music was, I'll be honest, I sort of got sick and tired of this whole old and new debate in music that happens amongst musicians. You know, well, that's the old thing, and oh, this is the new thing, and this is the old thing, and that's the new thing. And I'm like, wait a minute, actually, all of that stuff is old. And at some point, I said, you know what? Forget this. All of this stuff is old, and I'm going to use everything. How's that? No, shut up. And so, the way that I approach music now is that everything is on the table. I don't really care what it is. And I may not even be a fan of it, but I'll use it.
Now, modern jazz players, and I consider you a modern jazz player. I hope you consider yourself to be one and your entire family. They often criticize traditional New Orleans musicians as calling them mediocre, calling them, unimaginative. But the New Orleans guys say that the modern jazz guys can't play traditional jazz, you know, which is all about dance.
Yes.
You know? And so where do you fall in all of this?
And I have to pause for a minute to think about how to even explain all of this. Is that as the music evolved throughout the 20th century, there were a lot of changes once it got to New York and Chicago. Definitely New York, there's a lot of changes that happened with the music. And I mean, great developments and great changes. But I think that in New Orleans, a lot of the traditional music stayed the same.
Yes.
It really stayed the same. I mean, you'd have changes in music. You'd have different musicians, different songs, but that tradition sort of stayed the way that it was.
Right, and the repertoire, seemed to stagnate a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, but I think now you have guys trying to do new things. But no, the tradition stayed the same. But I think in New York you had a lot of changes. I think the reason for that is that, one, New Orleans is it's a slower moving pace, and New York is very fast. But also, I've made a statement that that musicians don't agree with, but I'm going to say it anyway, and that's I thought that New York hasn't really had its own music.
Oh.
Now, when you say that, it's like, no. Wait. You know, guys start getting up like, whoa, bro, hold on. Wait a minute. But I'm not even saying it as an insult, but what that meant was it was that in New Orleans, you had music that was folk music created that was particular to this very region, and it stayed. There's things about it that have changed. There's things that has evolved. But it's music that is about the culture that's here. Mm-hmm. But in New York, the music was about the change. What is the next thing we're going to do? And some of that was that the city itself was about, it was about welcoming different people.
Right,
was,
migrants coming to from around the country, coming or the world, coming to New York to play.
And that's how you get, say, music of Benny Goodman and Lionel Hampton to one era, to Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie to another era, to Miles Davis and Charles Mingus in another era. To, you know, you get all these changes that go down. But I've never heard that referred to as indigenous New York folk music, and it mm-hmm. shouldn't be. And then some will say, you know, that, well, hip-hop came from New York, and, I mean, that's debatable for a lot of reasons. And there
you are making enemies, my friend.
Oh, well. Oh, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I will make a lot of enemies. But, hey, that I'm trying to get a better understanding of why things take place. So to finish the point, a lot of the New York music has a lot of complexity. And I think you have great musicianship up there because you have a lot of guys that write these crazy arrangements, and you got to go in and read that and figure out how to play over it. Now, to be honest, some of it is great. Some of it is music I'm not into. Some of it is music I'd put on and then fall asleep after 15 minutes. But, I mean, it's not easy to play. I mean, you need high level of musicianship to play that music.
Sure.
Now, on the other hand, with New Orleans music, you know, that's more about, like, hearing and using your ears. There's not a lot of sight reading going on. In a lot of cases with traditional music, you know, you're dealing with more basics of harmony.
Yes.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, if you take a musician from each arena, they're going to both struggle. I mean, because I think on the one hand, the New Orleans guy is used to hearing things, and maybe they know a certain amount of tunes. They're going to be trying to sight read, like, man, what in the world is going on? But at the same token, a New York musician that's used to that put them in a trad band, and they're like, what are these guys doing? Of course, the only difference is that the New York guy has excuses. Their thing is, why are we playing this old music? Nobody cares about this anymore. Nobody wants to hear this anymore. This isn't relevant anymore. That's the difference. They have like a whole bunch of excuses together. You know, I think the New Orleans excuses is more like, you know, oh, nobody can dance to this and nobody cares. And I mean,
that's
they got
right.
those. But I think the New York excuses tend to make jazz magazines. But anyway, as far as I'm concerned, though, I can play in either situation. If you want to play odd meter, straight field, fine. I can go there. You want to play trad? That's cool. I can go there, too. You want to play odd-metered funk fusion? I'm there with you. Whatever you want to do. I mean, that's sort of what my goal is, in trying to get a better understanding of all those things, even if I'm not into it.
That's 7A Pocky Way by Jason Marcellus, a variation on the New Orleans classic first recorded by the Meters. Coming up, why Ray Charles makes everything sound better. Stay tuned. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. This song is called The Man with Two Left Feet by the Jason Marcellus Vibes Quartet. Jason Marcellus is with us. For a complete playlist of the songs in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. going to ask you a question that I'm sure you are very tired of answering, but no matter. What's the difference between a vibraphone and a xylophone?
Oh, yeah, I've never had to answer that. What I'm going to do, I'm actually going to walk over to the vibes
okay.
here.
Okay. This is a beautiful instrument with these golden tubes and...
Well, first thing is, let me see here, is the xylophone has a much, it's a brighter sound and it's a harder sound. And one of the best examples I can think of is the music from the Looney Tunes cartoons.
Okay.
You know, like when you hear like... Like there's xylophone, like that really, but this is a vibraphone, obviously, but that's like a high-pitched, piercing sound. Mm. But the best example for the vibraphone that I can tell people is that you've heard it used as a logo for the National Broadcasting Company.
Ooh.
And they all get it. Oh, yeah, we've heard that. They all know what that is. Now, I think this true, the differences between marimba, xylophone, and vibraphone are just in the bars and the type of bars and the type of mallets that you use to play them.
Okay, so you're carrying these beautiful mallets with, they look like diminished tennis balls.
Yeah, they're bigger mallets. Well, when Lionel Hampton started playing, you know, the mallets were a brighter sound. Later, Milt Jackson, he started to use bigger mallets.
Yes.
And it does have a warmer sound, so there's a point there. So there's that. Also, with the vibes, you have a motor which has resonators. And when Lionel Hampton was playing, the resonators were really fast.
At 10 revolutions per second, is that right?
I don't know if it's that many. With the resonators, that gives resonance to the bars. Because it would sound really flat. It would just sound like metal without them. And also, there's vibrato. And this is something you can't do on marimba or xylophone. There's
like the human voice.
And there's pedals. You know, so instead of... It's... And then when I turn on... Vibrato.
Wow.
You know. And so when Lionel Hampton used it, the speed was very fast, you know. Like up here, almost, you know. You know, just, you know, his whole thing was about groove, you know, like,
Is that bebop or rebop?
It's actually more like Hamp's Boogie Woogie, actually.
Ah, Hamp's Boogie Woogie.
I mean, same kind of thing, though, but it's mm-hmm. Hamp's Boogie Woogie, actually, you know, when they go. You know, and so forth and so on, and, you know, that's where that's from.
Yeah.
Now, Milt Jackson comes in. He's sort of the next sort of... You've had a lot of players.
That's right. You've got Lionel Hampton, who started in 1930, started recording in 1930 on vibraphone with Louis Armstrong, actually, right?
I think Memories of You was the first song.
Memories of
did.
You and Shine, I think, was the other song. And then here comes Milt Jackson, who really is a 40s and 50s kind of...
I think the next generation was really... signified by Milt Jackson, because Milt Jackson's thing was the notes were a little more legato. He was coming out of Charlie Parker.
Exactly.
You know, that's the thing. And so, you know, Milt's thing was more, you know. Like more legato, and his vibrato was slower, you know. Yeah, it was a different sound,
right?
You know?
But then when you hear Milt Jackson play, all of a sudden the vibraphone becomes an instrument that can suggest real emotional power. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly, you know, his recording with Ray Charles.
Oh, yes.
You
yes.
know, Soul Brothers.
Soul Meat. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And I think we have a song here that I love. And it's called How Long Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, it sounds so different from Lionel Hampton Fair. It doesn't diminish Hampton, but at the same time, yeah. it builds the power of the vibraphone.
Absolutely.
I mean, Ray Charles makes everything better, but this is like magic in the studio between Ray Charles and Milt Jackson.
Yeah, well, I think that when you have those two, you're dealing with musicians that have you have perspectives of jazz and blues and gospel music, old-time gospel music.
And so is it important for you to have emotional intensity in your vision of how you play vibraphone?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to have I think the full range of dynamics in music and emotion is very important to bring to the music, because I think it adds a lot of variety and it keeps the listener engaged.
Talk about the song Big Earl's Last Ride.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I mean, it's a very tender ballad.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that one.
Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us, who is Earl?
You know what's funny is that there wasn't a real Earl.
Really?
Yeah, it was Big Girl. That was the actual title. And I'm just going to leave it there. You know, it was written by bassist Will Goble.
Okay, let's listen to it.
I wanted to have a song where I would play quiet and slow. And so, you know, I made sure to play a solo that would have sustained notes. Of course, I was dealing with counter lines and so forth and things, but I think that's a different character of the instrument.
About your whistle.
Oh, yeah.
You're a good whistler.
Sometimes, yes.
I mean, you know, there's a long tradition of great whistling in New Orleans, among New Orleans musicians. Like Earl King was a great whistler.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Longhair was a great whistler. Johnny Adams was a great whistler. And here comes Jason Marcellus. You actually got something going there.
Yeah, there was a book that I read when I was a little kid, probably 5 or 6 years old, called Whistle for Willie by Ezra Jack Keats.
Whistle for Willie.
Yes, and I remember being into that book and like, man, I gotta figure out how to whistle, you know. I figured out how to do it. Now, as a kid, I would always sing along to these jazz records, and I would sing along to these solos. Well, when you go through puberty and your voice gets all low, you can't really do that. So then I started whistling to them.
So is that you on the record, Whistle for Willie? Is that you whistling?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Is that one take?
Yeah.
Now, in 2014, three Marsalis brothers put out albums. You clearly do not coordinate.
No.
Okay, so
nope.
Delfeo Marsalis, the trombonist, put out an album. Branford Marsalis put out his solo album at the Grace Church Cathedral in San Francisco. And then you and your quartet put out your most recent album, right?
Yes.
The 21st Century Trad Band. Now, but what's interesting about the three projects is that, you know, each of your senses of humor come through on these recordings. You know what I mean? You're not afraid to have fun and to bring a smile. So for instance, Branford Marsalis, he plays Carol Burnett's I'm So Glad We Had This Time Together.
Yes, sure did.
Right?
Yeah, I got to learn that myself, actually. I've thought about playing that myself.
That's
but
a good
anyway.
Song. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And then Delfeo Marsalis does, can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
Yes.
I mean, how often do you hear that within a jazz milieu? It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. No, the Sesame, the classic theme, if you turn on Sesame Street on PBS now, it's a totally different theme. You know, it's more hip-hop. In
Everything
fact,
changes.
That's what America does. We need to do something new and different, you know, like the jazz world.
So do you plan on recording a television theme anytime soon?
Nothing's off the table. It would be anything from the 20th century, anything.
Like TV, Bonanza.
Oh, whatever. Yeah. I don't really know Bonanza as well, but yeah, it could be something like Transformers or Rocky and Bullwinkle, which is insane music, or, you know, Odd Couple, which it might happen.
It sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, I mean,
it really does.
Yeah, there's a lot of music that was happening on those shows then.
It's true. And so what would you like to leave us with today?
I guess just some blues.
The blues. Well, I tell you, that's always a favorite over here. Yeah.
Sure. Let me see here. And I might play vibes and whistle, too.
Fantastic. Jason Marsalis is leader of the Jason Marsalis Vibes Quartet. He joined us with his vibraphone at Marini Recording Studio. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you for doing this. You've been wonderful.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show was produced by Lynette Johnson, Rick G. Nelson, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For more information about Jason Marsalis and a playlist of today's show, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, the Arts Council New Orleans, Surf Song Realty of Orange Beach, Alabama, Adam Newman Designs, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax-deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.